All right, today we are going to be picking up on our series through the Gospel of Mark. And the last thing that we talked about before we took a break for the practice of Sabbath was a confrontation between Jesus and the Pharisees around doing all the right things the right way. And one of the challenges that we saw through that text is that the teachers of the law, the Pharisees, the Sadducees, had been really caught up on what they called the traditions of the elders, and which were additional commandments that they threw in on top of the ones God had given them. So if you're going to follow Torah, their idea was, why not go the extra mile? But in going the extra mile, they began to make it mandatory, and you would be judged on how good of a follower you were based on not just following Torah, but following all these extra things they threw on top of that. And one of those that Jesus kind of stumbles into is one where they wash themselves before a meal. And sometimes they would wash like the whole house or the places you would sit, and they felt like you needed to be ceremonially cleansed. Nowhere in the Old Testament was that something that you were instructed to do. But they felt like, since you needed, when you went into the temple or into the synagogue, you needed to wash yourself and be cleansed, why not do that all the time and do that before every meal? And so they confronted Jesus and said, why aren't you following all the rules? Now, I don't know where everyone has come from. I know most of your stories, but not all your stories. But some of us came up in a setting that we were regularly judged based on how closely we followed all the rules. I've shared some of the stories of mine. One was how we dressed, and one I had some people get really upset with me when I would preach without a tie, which, of course, you think is crazy. Mark has ever worn a tie? But there was a time where I wore a suit and a tie every Sunday morning, but then I started dressing down because the number of people that were coming to our church that had not been attending a church, they just weren't used to that and they weren't comfortable with that. And a good number of people that started attending our church at the time were in kind of a lower social income class, and so they couldn't go out and buy all the fancy clothes. And so I thought, why am I going to stand up here and become a barrier? Scripture doesn't say anything about dressing up like this. But it's become an unspoken rule in many places that you got to wear your absolute best. And that is kind of the idea that Jesus confronts them on. And this is what he said in Mark 7:6. And this is just, I'm just preparing you for where we're headed today. He said to them, "Did Isaiah prophesy of you hypocrites, as it is written, 'This people honors me with their lips, but their heart is far from me. In vain do they worship me, teaching as doctrines the commandments of men.' You leave the commandment of God and hold to the tradition of men." And he said to them, "You have a fine way of rejecting the commandment of God in order to establish your tradition." Now, I wanted to bring that back up just to tie us back into where we've been in the Gospel of Mark. But I also, because what we're going to look at today happens immediately after this moment. And this moment is going to be people outside the Jewish community who are approaching Jesus, who have a lot of trouble in their life. And what I know is that a lot of us in this room have had struggles throughout our lives. Either they're struggles that we're having currently, or they're struggles that we've had at different times in our lives. There was a time that the church began shifting the way we talked about the gospel, and we really wanted to make it enticing for people. And I remember so many times, and I've said it myself so many times, if you will give your heart to Jesus, then everything will be okay. Jesus will make your path straight, and he will solve your problems. There's not technically anything wrong with what I just said, but we began to communicate, if you're a good Christian, you won't have trouble. But what you and I know is, it's not about whether you will have trouble. It's about how are you going to deal with trouble when trouble comes. Jesus said this in John 16:32. He said, "The hour is coming, indeed it has come, when you will be scattered, each to his own home, and will leave me alone. Yet I am not alone, for the Father is with me. I have said these things to you, that in me you may have peace. In the world you will have tribulation, or some of your translations say you will have trouble. But take heart, I have overcome the world. So my hope today is to walk through two stories that are going to talk about the ways that we approach trouble and the way that Jesus approaches trouble within our lives. And it's told through the story of a Syrophoenician woman, which is how she is talked about in the Gospel of Mark. In the Gospel of Matthew, she's called a Canaanite woman, but the story is the same. We're going to look at a connection to the Old Testament because Jesus is absolutely mimicking an event that has already happened. And we're going to talk a little bit about that, and then I'm going to give you some takeaways. And that's kind of going to be our time today. Let's start with the story of the Syrophoenician woman. And we have a woman who is struggling with a child who she says is possessed by a demon. Now, I don't know about you. I think that every child goes through a time when they're possessed by a demon. Amen? It generally happens around 2, and I'm not real sure when it ends. But it generally starts around 2 years old. We were told it was the terrible 2s. We found the terrible 2s lasted a little longer than a year, you know. But in this case, we have a mother who is incredibly distraught over a child and the condition of the child. My guess is if you're a parent, you have been through a moment where you have been terribly distraught over your child. If you are not the parent of a child, I'm guessing there's been a moment you've been in terribly distraught over a person that you care about deeply. As we go into this story, this is where Jesus is going to encounter this woman, and he's going to have an incredible conversation with her that we got to kind of unpack a little bit. But also, I hope that when you walk out of here today, you will see that Jesus' concern for what's going on in your life and the troubles that you're going through are significant. He is with you. He groans with you. He mourns with you. He is in it with you. But often when we go through a hard time, we feel like we are completely and wholeheartedly all alone. So let's jump into the story. This is going to be in Mark chapter 7, beginning with verse 24. It says, "And from there," after this moment he's just had arguing with the, not arguing, but talking about traditions and the traditions of men and the Pharisees who think that Jesus just isn't a good enough Jew. "He rose from there and he went away to the region of Tyre and Sidon." Now, a few weeks ago, we talked about another demon-possessed man who was in the Decapolis. And we talked about the Decapolis as being a Gentile area. If there were Jews in the Decapolis, they were not practicing Jews. You don't go to the Decapolis if you're a practicing Jew. If you're someone who's serious about your faith, you stay with the other Jews. And you kind of go to those areas of the Sea of Galilee. You don't go to the Decapolis. And we have this incredible moment in which Jesus takes his disciples to this Gentile-laden place, a place where the Jews felt like they shouldn't be going because we just don't have anything to do with the Gentiles. He takes them there and encounters a man who has this multitude of demons within him. He says he is legion. When we talked about that story, we talked about the political connections with Rome and how much of the imagery of that story were tying back to Rome. But this man, Jesus heals him, and this man says, "Let me follow you." And Jesus says, "No, it's not your time to follow me." He says, "Go away." And the man goes away and he begins telling everybody about what Jesus had done for him. Can I just tell you that that type of testimony is more important than the 3 Bible verses on how to stay out of hell and go into heaven? The testimony of what Jesus has done for us is so much more powerful than if you were to die tonight, would you go to heaven or would you go to hell? I'm just telling you, when Jesus does something within us, why is this good news to us? This is a question that we all have to struggle with. For this demon-possessed man, he knew the good news. I was oppressed. I was an outcast. I was naked. My life was no longer my own. And he showed up and he completely changed everything. Look at me. I'm a completely different person. I am healed. And what we're going to find over this week and next week is the word about Jesus just begins spreading like wildfire. in this area of Gentiles who are not observant Jews. And in that environment, we have Jesus coming into this moment of Tyre and Sidon, which is also in the same general area. The Decapolis is just, it just means 10 cities. There are 10 cities in that area, and these are two of them. He arose and went to the region of Tyre and Sidon, and he entered a house and did not want anyone to know. So interesting how many places Jesus is trying to hide the story. In the parables and in this moment, I don't want people to know I'm here, but it gets out. He did not want anyone to know, yet he could not be hidden. And immediately a woman whose little daughter had an unclean spirit heard of him and came and fell down at his feet. Now the woman was a Gentile. That's important information. Gentiles to Jews were just non-people. They would often refer to them in some kind of a derogatory fashion, but their favorite word to describe a Gentile was kind of a rabid, loose, wild dog. Just call them dogs. That's important when we come into the rest of this story. This kind of, if you just get this picture of the most raggedy dog that's just been out wandering and is snarling, and just the kind of dog that you go the other way when you see it, that's the way that often the Jews would refer to the Gentiles, which if you're thinking, well, that doesn't sound good. No, it's not. And that's part of the reason for this story, is that the Jews constantly miss what God's been trying to do this whole time. So that information, that woman was a Gentile, is important. Jesus shouldn't be concerned with her. They would even go so far that if you touched a Gentile, to say that you were unclean, and until you were ceremonially washed, you would not be clean again. Which again, is not only not in Scripture, it's completely opposite from the heart of God, and completely opposite from the heart of Jesus. But that information is important as the story continues. Immediately a woman whose little daughter had an unclean spirit, verse 26. Now the woman was a Gentile, a Syrophoenician by birth, and she begged him to cast the demon out of her daughter. Begged him. That is an incredibly important part of this story. If you've been distraught over a loved one, whether it be a child, whether it be a spouse, a parent, a brother or sister, a cousin, a good friend, a coworker, if you've been distraught over them, there has likely been a time, if you are a person of faith, that you have begged God to intervene, to do something, to make a difference, to turn the tables, to give an opening, an opportunity. So this is the kind of the emotional state that this mom is in. She begged him to cast the demon out of her daughter. And he said to her, "Let the children be fed first," which is kind of an interesting part of this story, because for us, reading it in our modern context, like, children have not been introduced in this story yet. Who are these children? Is he talking about her child? It says, "For it is not right to take the children's bread and throw it to the dogs." Now, if you want to get upset with Jesus, this is a good place to do it. If you want to think that Jesus is inappropriate, this is a good place to do it. The only problem is you have to ignore all of the clues of this ancient Near Eastern context to get to the place to see what Jesus is doing. There are a few words in Hebrew that when we use them, they're going to mean different things, even though the translators of the Bible you hold in your hands or in your phone or however you read the Bible, we're going to translate them to the same word in English, but they're going to have different meanings based on the use, the way it's used in the sentence, the punctuation. All of it is going to be just slightly nuanced by the fact of how it's used in this place, but it's going to use one word in English. The word dogs can be used to describe that dog I just described, the wild dog, the mangy dog, the rabbi-ridden dog, the one that you want to put down or want to be away from. Excuse me. In this place, the word for dog that Jesus is using seems to be an intentional play on words for the benefit of the disciples who are listening in. Excuse me. The disciples, it doesn't say this in Mark, but it says it in Matthew, that literally this woman is begging so incessantly that the disciples come to Jesus and say, send her away because she will not leave us alone. Like, get rid of her. She is not someone that we need to be associating with. We have come here to get away. She's bothering us, and she just won't stop. We're going to come back to that in a minute. Because there's going to be some characters in this story that get Jesus, and there are going to be some characters in this story that don't. And many times, as the disciples are growing into their role as apostles, many times they miss the point of what Jesus is trying to do. But the very people around them that they have disdain for, they actually see Jesus for who he is and for what he's really about. This word for dogs is not the mangy wild dog. This word for dogs, for some of you who have cute little puppies that you like to sit with you and they just are your best friend, and you know, you snap pictures with them and you see them and you melt, and you know, you've gone to the refrigerator and you get the bag of pepperonis out for yourself and then they just sit there and drool. I'm talking about my own experience. But you know what I mean. There are two different ways. We read this as Jesus saying, Jesus, why would you call her a dog? But instead, he's using this play on words that the disciples can hear, that they themselves have this view of the Gentiles, at least right now in the story. But for him, he uses a term of endearment for kind of your favorite pet. And at this moment, she could respond with disdain, anger, frustration, how offended I am that you would use that word against me. But she picks up on this language. She picks up on this nuance that he's using the word that she undoubtedly has heard from the Jewish people that would travel through the Decapolis. She's undoubtedly heard it time and time again, but he uses the word differently. And she doesn't see it as a criticism or him putting her down. She sees it as an invitation to engage Jesus, which is exactly what he's trying to do here. Verse 28, but she answered him, yes, Lord, yet even the dogs under the table eat the children's crumbs. We're going to come back to that in a minute. And he said to her, for this statement you may go your way, the demon has left your daughter. And she went home and found the child lying in bed and the demon gone. Man, what a weird, weird story. And if you're someone who has been distraught over someone you care about, you may be wondering, how in the world does this relate to me? And I believe this relates to us in a few ways, but primarily it relates to the way that we see Jesus' desire to interact with our life through the troubles that we have. There are people that have gone through a lot of struggles, and the church has not been good about helping those in trouble. And sometimes we'll say something like, well, you did it to yourself. Or, you know, if you were following Jesus, this wouldn't have happened. Or this is just not the way a Christian's supposed to be. And it appears that Jesus might be giving that exact type of response to her. But when we understand his use of language is nuanced and meant to be picked up if you have eyes to see and ears to hear, which so much of what he did required that you pay attention, not just take a cursory reading and go, oh, I got it. You may not, because Jesus was a teacher of nuance. Just like the parables, I teach in a way that you have to want it to get it, but you won't get it if you don't want it. She was desperate. She believed Jesus could do something. Her child seemed to be afflicted with the exact same ailment, likely as the man that she heard about Jesus, if she didn't already know who he was. Being possessed by a demon. She believed he could do something about it. And she engaged him by saying, listen, I may not be a Jew. I may just be a dog, as they often like to call us. But those family pets that we love so much, they get crumbs off the table. Can I just get a crumb, even if it's not meant for me to have everything that you're here to provide? Man, what an incredible mom. To struggle with her child's struggles. To know there's nothing I can do about this. I've tried everything I know to try. I've gone to all the people that can do anything about it. She's probably listened to all of her friends who have told her, you know what, this is what I would do if I were you. And her last hope is this Jewish Messiah who's not supposed to have anything to do with her because she was born in the wrong place at the wrong time. Four things I want you to see about this woman. She was desperate to help her child, and you'll notice she says, "Have mercy on me." She's feeling this pain. She's upset. She's hurting. Have mercy on me. Heal my daughter. The text says she falls on her feet. This is an act of begging. How many of us would beg for something? What would it take for us to get to the place that we would be on our knees begging for something? Just the sheer magnitude of the emotion around this moment is evident just in the few details that we have. She was desperate to help her child. You know what it feels like to be desperate in a moment. To help someone and feel like you have nothing to offer, no way to help. The second thing we see from her is that she was persistent. This is the idea of chutzpah, which literally means insolence or audacity. She kept at it. She stayed there. Well, I don't think I would have kept talking with him if he called me a dog. I mean, she stayed there. She was persistent. When they talk about let the little children eat, what Jesus is saying is, I've come here first for the Jews and then for the Gentiles, even though he doesn't quite say it that way. And she's saying, just because you're not here for me right now, can you still help me? Do you still care about me? Am I still someone that's of value that you would do something for? Because I know it's in your power to do. And what we've seen in the disciples is that they are not in this place to care about someone who was not born in the right place at the right time. Let's get rid of her, Jesus. She's just a nuisance. She won't stop talking. She won't leave us alone. We're not even here for her. She was persistent. Third thing we see from her story is that she was incredibly humble. She describes herself as one of these little children. She puts herself in the position of the household pet who says, just let me have the crumbs that fall off the table. You're giving the main course to them. I understand that. But there are those of us here, we've heard who you are. We've heard what you can do. Let us just get a taste of what you're here to give them. Just a taste. She was so incredibly humble. James 4, 6 through 7 says, he gives more grace. Therefore it says, God opposes the proud, but gives grace to the humble. Submit yourselves therefore to God. Resist the devil, and he will flee from you. I wonder what would happen if she reared up at the use of that word dog. I knew you were no better than them. I used to visit a man in our community, and he wouldn't go to church, but his entire family went to church. And I would just go sit with him, and I sat with him in the last days of his life, and he was ill, and some of the reasons that he was dying were some bad choices he made in his life that just made his body decay faster than it should have. But I would go and sit with him and talk with him. Just, I cared about him. He was a neighbor of mine, but also, I cared about his family who were a part of our church. And so I would just go sit and I would talk with him. And I just asked him, I said, you know, it doesn't look like you're coming back from this. I mean, anything could happen and only God knows what's going to happen in your life. But it doesn't look like you're going to come back from this. What is holding you back from just giving your heart to Jesus? I mean, you're here at the end of your life. I don't believe he was as antagonistic to the gospel as he was to the church. But I'll never forget his words to me. He said, I know those people in that church, and I know that they're no better than me, even though they act like it when they're in church. So many times we approach someone that doesn't look right, talk right, act right, and we throw condemnation on them. His point was what so many have also made of the same point. My frustration is not necessarily with this idea of Jesus. My frustration are with the people who claim to represent Jesus, who treat me like I'm no good, and I know they're no better than I am. I believe he did, in the very last hours of his life, finally make a decision to say, I do need Jesus. In the final hours of his life. That conversation directed a lot of our future conversations because we started getting really vulnerable. One of the reasons that authenticity is an important thing for us here, I learned in a series of those conversations, that Christian platitudes don't set anyone free. It's lives that authentically engage with Jesus that do. I needed to stop acting like I had my life together, or I'm the preacher doesn't make mistakes, and recognize there is a common humanity among us that we are in need because we all struggle. Maybe I hadn't made all the choices that he made. I made all different ones. What does it look like to have compassion? For her, Jesus was having compassion in this moment, even if we don't recognize it, but she responded so humbly. I don't need status. I don't need you to pump me up. I don't need you to tell me I'm even as good as your people over there. I just need you in this moment. I believe Jesus enters into our lives in those moments of humility that we're at the end of our rope. And that's one of the reasons that so many of the most compelling testimonies out there are people that have been through incredibly hard things. You're just kind of, I'm at the end. I don't care about being on a pedestal. I don't care about people treating me like I'm better than anybody else. I know where I am. I need help. Will you help me? Or to help? I've known a lot of people who have told Jesus how he needs to help, that Jesus doesn't choose to work in the way that he has been instructed that he's supposed to do. Right? So many times I come to Jesus, I'm like, Jesus, that was not what I meant. You ever prayed that prayer? That was not what I meant. Try again. And Jesus would probably respond, if I heard him audibly, well, that's exactly what I meant. She was humble. And number four, she had great faith. A lot of you know my day job, so that I can do this, is working in digital marketing. And one of the services I provide is hosting for a number of different websites around the world. And at times, my server will go down, and a lot of times I can fix it, but there are sometimes I'm not an expert in it. There are sometimes that I don't know how to fix it. And so I'll call up technical support, and I'll say, hey, this is what's happening. I don't really know how to fix it. While at that time, everybody who's using that server in my mind is about to fire me because their site's not working. And if your website's not up, it's not good for your reputation. And every single time they come back and they say, hey, I think this is the problem. It's fixed. I see the sites are back up. everything's good. Do you think I say, okay, thanks, see ya, before I look and check myself? The answer would be no, because so many times I have trusted that it was fixed and it's not fixed, and then I've got to jump back in the queue and wait another 30 minutes to talk to somebody again or longer. What's so interesting about this moment is this woman doesn't say, would you come with me? Can we check if she's okay? Because I would have been like, hey, if I have a cell phone, hey, can you just double check? Is she doing all right? I mean, is she all right? Before I let this guy go, I got him. I mean, he's paying attention to me right now. I don't want to let him go because I'll never get him back. She just says thank you and she goes. Her faith is so full and pure. You can do this. He says he's done it. That means it's done. Man, she had great faith. A few weeks ago, we talked about some of the parables about the kingdom, and we talked about one about the mustard seed. And the kingdom of God is like a little seed, the smallest of all seeds. We know that there are smaller seeds than the mustard seed, but at this time and in this place, this is the smallest seed they had. And faith the size of a mustard seed, just tiny, can grow and grow and grow. And we saw that it could grow, in that story, it can grow into a tree. And the tree would be so substantial that birds could come and roost in the branches. And then we jump back and we look for a reference in the Old Testament that maybe Jesus was referencing the Old Testament, which is usually what Jesus is doing. If you're not a student of the Old Testament, you're not likely to understand what Jesus is really trying to say, because he uses the Old Testament to talk about what's happening in that moment. And we found a passage that said the birds represented all the people of all the nations of the world that were not God's chosen people, and said that when the Messiah comes, the birds will come and nest in his branches. This idea that even in the Old Testament, beginning with the promise to Abram, this message was always going to be for the whole world. The Jews were just a called out people for a moment in time to introduce how God was going to save the world. But this message was always for everybody in the whole world. She had great faith. Even the size of a mustard seed produces great fruit. Matthew tells that moment where she asks him for crumbs a little differently than Mark does. In Matthew 15:27, she said this instead, "Yes, Lord, yet even the dogs eat the crumbs that fall from their master's table." Then Jesus answered him, "O woman, great is your faith. Be it done for you as you desire." And her daughter was healed instantly. This quid pro quo conversation between Jesus and this woman was to see, do you really understand what you're asking? Do you really know who you're talking to? Do you really want this thing that I'm here for? Or do you just want me to fix this trouble that's in your life right now? And she responds with this beautiful idea, we are all under the master's table. This word master, the root word, will be used to describe rabbi in the Hebrew. You are the teacher. You are the one who leads us. We are all under your table. We are all under your house. Now, this is someone that doesn't believe, and the Jews have done everything they can to show her this is not for you. And Jesus over and over again keeps saying, yes, it is. What an incredible story. If we go back, I'm going to read this story. I'm not going to talk deeply about it. But if we go back, and for those who were paying attention, the story mimics another story in one of your favorite books of the Bible, 1 Kings. I know you all have read through 1 Kings regularly, right? have it memorized, you know, everything that happens there. You're like, yeah, I know. That's the one that comes right before 2 Kings, right? That's the one. This story is eerily similar to a story that happens not to Jesus, but to Elijah, which is important for us to understand also what's happening here. Let me just read the story. You pick up on the details. Then the word of the Lord came to him, "Arise, go to Zarephath, which belongs to Sidon." Where did this happen with the Syrophoenician woman? Do you remember? In Sidon. "And dwell there." This is Elijah he's talking to. "Behold, I have commanded a widow there to feed you." So he arose and went to Zarephath. And when he came to the gate of the city, behold, a widow was there gathering sticks. And he called to her and said, "Bring me a little water in a vessel that I may drink." And she was going to bring it. He called to her and said, "Bring me a morsel of bread in your hand." We're introducing an idea of bread here, where we've already talked about the idea of bread crumbs. "Bring me a little bread, a morsel of bread in your hand," a crumb of bread, you might say. And she said, "As the Lord your God lives, I have nothing baked, only a handful of flour in a jar and a little oil in a jug. And now I am gathering a couple of sticks that I may go in and prepare it for myself and my son that we may eat at it and die." She is in dire straits, she and her child. Sounds like a similar story so far. And Elijah said to her, "Do not fear, go and do as you have said, but first make me a little cake of it and bring it to me, and afterward make something for yourself and your son. For thus says the Lord, the God of Israel, the jar of flour shall not be spent, and the jug of oil shall not be empty until the day the Lord sends rain upon the earth." And she went and did as Elijah said, and she and he and her household ate for many days. The jar of flour was not spent, neither did the jug of oil become empty, according to the word of the Lord that he spoke by Elijah. After this, the son of the woman, the mistress of the house, became ill. So now we have a woman with a child who's in dire straits. And she said in verse 18 to Elijah, "What have you against me, O man of God? You have come to me to bring my sin to my remembrance and to cause the death of my son." And he said to her, "Give me your son." And he took him from her arms and carried him up into the upper chamber where he lodged and laid him on his own bed. And he cried to the Lord, "O Lord my God, have you brought calamity even upon the three times? Even upon the widow with whom I sojourned by killing her son." Then he stretched himself upon the child three times and cried to the Lord, "O Lord my God, let this child's life come into him again." And the Lord listened to the voice of Elijah, and the life of the child came into him again, and he revived. And Elijah took the child and brought him down from the upper chamber into the house and delivered him to his mother. And Elijah said, "See, your son lives." And the woman said to Elijah, "Now I know that you are a man of God and that the word of the Lord in your mouth is truth." A woman with a child in dire straits is eating crumbs. Her child dies. Elijah intervenes, heals the child by raising the child, presumably from this text, from the dead. And she has a faith response to what he has done, claiming your God, not her God. She's not a Hebrew. She's not a Jew. Your God is Lord. There are many places that Jesus is trying to show us some of the ways you've interpreted the events of the Old Testament you've just gotten wrong. One of them being previously in this chapter of Mark, just before the Syrophoenician woman, when the leaders of the law said, "You must follow the traditions of men," you have missed it. And Jesus is showing us time and time again, "I'm here to show you, I am the incorporation of all those that you read about in the Old Testament. I am the new Moses. I am the new Elijah. The same thing that happened to Elijah, I'm doing the same thing here. I am the one." Jesus doesn't waste a moment. to say, this is what the gospel is about. This is what it's about. We follow a second story in Mark chapter 7, beginning with verse 31. We're going to go through this one kind of quickly. This story, while the story of the Syrophoenician woman focuses on her, her response to Jesus, and the characteristics of who she is, we have more here demonstrating the character of Jesus and just a little bit of interaction with a man who is deaf, who is somehow tongue-tied, he's having trouble speaking, and he approaches Jesus in a different place, in Tyre, also in the Decapolis, also a Gentile, and he approaches Jesus, and this is how this story goes. Then he returned from the region of Tyre and went through Sidon to the Sea of Galilee, in the region of the Decapolis. Now, people who are really adept at biblical geography will tell you, Jesus is not moving from Sidon to Tyre back to the Jews. He's actually moving away from the Jewish-held region of the Sea of Galilee. Jesus is going deeper into Gentile territory. He's not going out of it. He's going into it. Next week, we're going to talk about the feeding of the 4,000. If you weren't here for the story of the feeding of the 5,000, you should go back and listen to it, either on our website or our podcast, because we have this other great story that this feeding of the 4,000 happens in the Decapolis as well. And all these people are coming, presumably because of that one demon-possessed man who went and told everybody, look what God has done for me. It says verse 32, they brought to him a man who was deaf and had a speech impediment, and they begged him to lay his hand on him. And taking him aside from the crowd privately, he put his fingers into his ears, and after spitting, touched his tongue. Not my favorite way of being healed, to be quite honest with you. And looking up to heaven, he sighed. Now this sigh can be interpreted lots of different ways. You ever been in an argument with your significant other and you sigh and it makes everything twice as bad as it was to begin with? Y'all done that? Like there are some inappropriate moments for sighs, aren't there? Or you're talking to someone and your sigh is your response, you know? But that's not the sigh we're talking about here. This word sigh is the same word that describes the groanings, the deep groanings that the Holy Spirit intercedes for us. This sigh is not a with an eye roll. This sigh is a deep guttural, I feel you. I feel your pain. I can relate to you. I know you're struggling. He sighed, he groaned deeply beyond words. And he said, Ephphatha, that is, be opened. And his ears were open, his tongue was released, and he spoke plainly. And Jesus charged them to tell no one. But the more he charged them, the more zealously they proclaimed it. Why? Because when you have an experience with Jesus Christ, it changes you. You can have an experience with religion. You can have an experience with the text of the Bible. You can have an experience in church and walk away and never talk about it. When you have an experience with Jesus, you're different and you need to tell somebody. Have we had that experience where we just got to tell somebody? Every time we read that one of the Gentiles has an experience with Jesus, he's like, don't tell anybody because I'm not here for you yet. And they just tell everybody. Like they can't keep it in. They're just so overwhelmed because this is good news. Everybody should hear the good news. Verse 37, they were astonished beyond measure, saying, he has done all things well. He even makes the deaf hear and the mute speak. Here's what I want us to see about Jesus' response to him And also, I think we can easily say this is Jesus' response to you if you're going through trouble. Number one, Jesus cares about you no matter who you are or what you've done. Jesus cares about you no matter who you are or what you've done. I think they're just like my friend, who I had many conversations near the end of his life. It doesn't matter how bad they are or how good you think you are or how bad you think you are. Jesus cares about you. It doesn't matter if you're a Gentile. It doesn't matter if you've lost your hearing. He cares about you. Matthew 15:23 shows that the disciples had not yet learned this message. His disciples came and begged him, saying, "Send her away," talking about the Syrophoenician woman, "for she is crying out after us." This is not the way Jesus responds to people. If you believe Jesus only responds to good, whitewashed, perfect people, then you do not know who Jesus is. Because Jesus responds to everyone. Everyone. His love is for all people. Number two, Jesus compassionately understands your pain. This is that sigh, that groan. When you sit there in your house, in your chair, in your place by yourself, and you're in pain, and you're sweating, and your heart rate's going up, and you're frazzled, and you don't know what else to do, and you've tried everything else, Jesus is there with you in your heartache. He compassionately understands your pain. Romans 8:26, Paul says, "Likewise, the Spirit helps us in our weakness, for we do not know what to pray for as we ought, but the Spirit Himself intercedes for us with groanings or sighs too deep for words." As you sit there by yourself feeling all alone, like everyone's abandoned you, including Jesus, the Holy Spirit is interceding for you, groaning through your pain with you. And the third thing is this: Jesus will love you perfectly. The last verse of this story tells us He has done all things well, which points us back to the very character of God back in Genesis 1:31, when all He had created, He says, it's very good. So there are several messages that you can take away, and I will let you choose the one, or maybe you have a different one you have already determined. Several messages that you can take away from this as you leave today. One is, how do you respond to trouble? You fold it in, bring it in, don't let anybody know, pretend it's going to be okay when you feel like inside it's not. Do you lash out? Do you get angry? Do you become bitter? Do you blame God, blame Jesus, blame other people? How do you deal with trouble? I don't think most people end up in that place on the first go-around. It's when you've been sitting in it for a while that the anger and the bitterness comes in. How do you deal with trouble? We see with the woman, she dealt with it as she was desperate. When she was desperate, she came to Jesus. She was persistent. She had chutzpah. She was willing to be insolent and a frustration because only He has the answer. She responded with humility, and she believed that He would work. And because of her great faith, He did work. A second message that we cannot miss based on this conversation, especially between but where this is happening, who these people are, and the conversation with Jesus and between Jesus and the Syrophoenician woman is, we are called to bless all the nations. We're kind of in a political storm, have been for years now, where we want all the other nations out. I mean, we've even been labeled some of the worst ones. And I'll be honest, there are some nations that do evil, evil, evil things in the world. But as followers of Jesus, we're called to bless all the nations. And when we respond in the way that the disciples respond, "Send her away," where Jesus says, "I am here for you too." We at times have to change the way we respond to people. And maybe it's not people from another nationality. Maybe it's people. I had a conversation with someone the other day who was kind of visiting some churches and just said, you know, we've really struggled walking into churches and we've got tattoos and we just get lots of looks. I was like, really? Still? Like, that's still a thing? I mean, we really tried to fight that battle years ago and expunge the idea that somehow you're an idol worshiper if you have a tattoo. I mean, to be honest, my mom doesn't like them. She didn't like them. Whenever I told her, I think I'm going to get a tattoo, you know, I'm going to get one like The Rock, you know, the whole shoulder thing. I kind of feel like I look like him a little bit. I mean, you may disagree, but like I may do the whole thing. She would, kidding, of course. But there were some times I thought I'd really like to get a tattoo of that. She would come up with all the reasons. If you get skin cancer, like your whole arm will rot off before you know it. And, you know, it just all kinds of reasons why you shouldn't. Hers were never what we struggled with earlier in my ministry, which was, you're a bad person. You're a bad person if you have tattoos. It's crazy that that's still going on today. We are called to bless all the nations. And let me just say this. As a people who want to have the compassion of Jesus, we do not have to agree with the way a person lives for us to love that person. And have compassion on them. We are called to bless all the nations. This is what it looks like to follow Jesus. This is what he's trying to show his disciples. They will get this. But it's going to take time. There are so many lessons that I'm like, God, I'm just not up for this. I just don't agree with this. And he's like, God, either you will not follow me or you will get this over time, which is exactly what Paul says. Like, you don't agree with me now, but you will eventually. I love that response from him. It's so sarcastic. Like, I know you don't agree with me now, but you will eventually. Which, by the way, in this story, there's only two people that respond appropriately to Jesus. And they are both the Gentiles. And the deaf man's friends. Number three, message takeaway. Do we trust Jesus even when things aren't going the way we think they should? And this is a big one. Like, this is probably my struggle. I mean, there are times that I just think Jesus ought to be doing things different. I'm just being honest. I pray with specific intent in mind. This is how I want it resolved. And usually it doesn't resolve the way that I think it should be. But there are so many times I look back over my life and I look at the things and they don't go the way I think they should. But with time and reflection and with some other pieces moving in my life, I look back and go, that was exactly what should have happened. It just took me a while to get there. Do we trust Jesus even when things aren't going the way we think they should? What would it look like if we didn't worry about trouble? What if we look like if we were able to do the things that Jesus said when he says, don't worry? What would that life look like? I don't really know, to be honest, because I still worry about stuff. I don't worry near as much as I used to, but I still have stuff I worry about. What would it look like if we didn't worry about trouble? What if we look at that terrible situation with that person that we're desperate over and we have this overall peace that says it's going to be okay? Like, no one else says it's going to be okay, but I know Jesus, and Jesus says it's going to be okay. What happens if when trouble came, we were able to say it's going to be okay? What steps do you need to take to move in these directions? I think the Syrophoenician woman knew exactly what happened in 1 Kings with Elijah. They've been telling that story in Sidon ever since that day. She knew what happened. She knew that Jesus was the God that Elijah was praying to. Maybe we need to do some more study of Scripture so that it will come to mind during trouble. Know your text. One of the things I do in trouble is I try to remember when God's been faithful in the past, when I struggle to believe that God's faithful right now. Remember how God has shown up in the past. Hold loosely to your need for things to turn out a specific way. Remember that no matter what, Jesus loves you. and is working for your good, even when you feel all alone and maybe even abandoned. He does not abandon us. Next week, we're going to continue his dive into the Decapolis with the feeding of the 4,000. And we're just going to continue to see. I mean, these are people that are a crowd, hordes of people that are not supposed to be around Jesus. Jesus is not supposed to be around them. And yet, that's all I'm going to say. We'll talk about that story next week. I don't know what your response is today, and it may be that the trouble within your life is so overwhelming you can't think about anything else, but I just want you to know, no matter how dire things get, there is always a way.